Good afternoon, everybody. This is Connie Spruill, and today our interview is going to be with an attorney by the name of Claudia Harrington, and I'm not going to even attempt to describe her background. I'm going to let her tell you a little bit about her experience, the field she's worked in, and why we're interviewing her related to online businesses and the things that we need to be cognizant of. So, Claudia, tell us a little bit about your background.
Thank you, Connie. And Kathy and Sylvia and Delinda, I'm so excited to be sharing this time with you today. So thank you so much for your time. So I just to give you a brief snapshot of my background, I've been an attorney for over 20 years, and I have spent the last 10 years in somewhat of a bifurcated role in that I've practiced law for a really long time, and then I had the opportunities to branch out and evolve my career in the areas of ethics and compliance, federal regulations in certain industries, as well as corporate governance. I, too, am a small business owner. I've had my own consulting company for about 4 years. I do various types of work, both legal work and regulatory and compliance work for small companies and startups, as well as I have an international client who is in the startup phase as well. I am the past president of the Ohio Women's Bar Association, and I am an adjunct professor on the faculty at Otterbein University, and I teach corporate risk management in the MBA program. So a little bit of a smattering just to give you an idea of my background.
Wow. I mean, talk about a lot of things you can help us with. And I understand that you very quickly have an extensive background in legalities related to online business conduction. And you're going to talk to us a little bit about that, both locally, USA total, and international. But before we get to that, there's some probably simpler questions that we'd like for you to talk to us about. And that is, where should we be concerned regarding trademarking, like our logos, our company name, the website name, copywriting, and patent? You might also help some who would be listening to this later. What's the difference between the three?
Sure. Let's sort of talk about that piece. So, and they are a bit different. So when you patent something, you are patenting an invention. Could be a thing, like a widget, or it could be a process, but you're creating something new and you're inventing something. Trademark and copyright is something that we see in a lot of written material. It could be, you could trademark a song, the name of something, a book. So we see a lot of trademark and copywriting in our everyday life. It could be a phrase, it could be a company name, it could be the logo on your website, it should be the logo on your website. So those types of things are copyright and trademark. So the TM, when you start a company, so if you go online and you fill out the forms for the Secretary of State and you start, say, an LLC and you come up with that company name, you can, when you post on your website, you can put that little TM right next to it, because a TM, a trademark, you can also have a trademark as it relates to in common law. The copyright piece is the more formalized process as well, and that's the circle C. You do the trademark, copyright, and patent piece through the USPTO, which is the United States Patent and Trademark Office. Trademarks actually are the most consuming piece of getting a trademark or a copyright on your material, even a patent on your invention, is the time that it takes to get it, because it is quite a long process. I've done it for other clients. I've filed trademarks. I've received trademarks. It takes a little bit of time. They have a process. The USPTO is unlike other federal offices that I've had to work with. They are pretty efficient. If they say in 6 months they're going to get back to you, they surely do. I mean, they are easy to work with, but they have set time frames, and it's the time that it takes to achieve these marks or rights that seem to take a lot of time. A trademark on a logo could cost you anywhere from $225 to $275. And it really just takes time and filling out the paperwork and then having someone, having a representative and paying the fee. But where people find it more excruciating, if you will, is just the time waiting to get word back from the USPTO.
Okay, and regarding the trademarking, is it true? Someone had told me that if you're going to trademark a logo or a design or a cartoon or whatever it is that you're using in your business, that you have to do it in each state in the United States. Is that true? And then internationally? Or is that something I'm thinking of?
I will tell you this. If you trademark at the U.S. at the federal level with the United States PTO office, it works across the U.S.
Oh, another okay. That's good to
thing,
know.
Well, and I will tell you something that's sort of interesting. The client that I have in Europe, he wanted to get trademarks in the U.S. because it is viewed as a pretty high standard in other countries. So if you have that little TM after your name, your competitors in other countries are like, okay, this is legitimate. This is a going concern. This is a business. And so it has stature, actually, the U.S. trademark and copyright symbols. It actually has stature in other countries, which is one of the reasons why he wanted to get some stuff. He wanted to get some trademarks in the U.S.
Okay, and you did say that once we've formed the company name, we can put the little TM after it, even though we haven't gone through that process.
Yes, because it's called a common law, and that's there's a predicate to that too. Let me just back up for just one second. When you file, when you decide, okay, here's the name of my company, XYZ Company. When you go on to the Ohio Secretary of State's website, you'll see if that's taken or not. And if it's not taken, you can definitely use it. But you also want to make sure that you can research, not just in your state. What I would also recommend is you go online and you put XYZ Company in, and you see what comes up, if anything comes up. And if other companies are called the same type of thing, well, you know, what service or product do they offer? Is it may be okay to have the same name as somebody who has a company in Wyoming, because what you do is vastly different, and there's no opportunity for confusion between your business and that other person's business. So I look locally, and I would just check nationally as well, just to make sure that the name, that you're not going to have problems down the road if someone saying, you know what, really, I had that name first.
Okay, that's good to know. Tell me a little bit about how right now everybody is moving, even if they already have a brick and mortar store, they are moving online because that is the way people are shopping.
Yeah.
How
absolutely.
Do we make sure that our site data, or what should we know about keeping the data on our site secure for our clients and in some cases patients?
True. Okay, so how do you guys protect what you view as your intellectual property? So,
right.
Again, all right, so the trademark piece is really important for your logos and stuff like that. Another thing, too, that you will see on websites, you'll see it in books, too, but I think we get out of the book era and we stay in this digital era that we're in right now, because you're absolutely right. People are ordering things online, and they're having it shipped to their house because we're all so darn busy, and this is a way to get everything done. And with Amazon and Amazon Prime in 2 days till you receive it, I mean, it's amazing. So another thing, too, so we'll stay in the digital realm. Another thing, too, is at the bottom of your website, you can put all rights reserved. That means that you are going to, that is an indicator to other people looking at your website that I take my stuff seriously, and if you try to take it, I'm going to pursue it.
Okay. I always wondered what that all rights reserved actually stood for. What is it saying? Because it didn't make any sense to me.
Right. It's a lot about a lot like the common law trademark. The all rights reserved means that you are taking ownership of this, and you're reserving your right if anybody else tries to take your material. So you have the common law trademark on your logos. Your logos or any interesting ideas that you have or concepts, like if you've created a concept, trademark that as well. I would also, if you put it on your website and you haven't done the paperwork, you haven't gone that full route to the USPTO, I would put it on my website because you can under common law, but I would still follow through with that paperwork piece and I'd pay the fee.
Okay.
So that way you've got that federal piece. So you've got the trademark, you've got all rights reserved. I think another place too that you can work to ensure that you are protecting your intellectual property is in your terms and conditions. At the bottom of websites, they'll say all rights reserved. They'll have a place for you to click on a privacy policy, maybe a cookies policy, and maybe terms and conditions. And in that terms and conditions, you can say, you know, that you will enforce your rights as it relates to your work. Another thing, too, as it relates to, like, webinars or blogs or podcasts, if there's any way that you can limit the access, that people have to have, like, a password or you can lock it down or they have to be a customer or a client before they can get access, those are other ways, too, that you can protect your intellectual property and the things that you do.
The certification school, all our webinars and recorded videos are up on Vimeo, which is mm-hmm. a really good site I recommend people to go to, because you can click on a little button that says, if someone copies this link to this
right.
video or this webinar, they cannot play it off of the site that it's on.
That's right. That's right. Agreed.
So there are tools that can prevent that. So.
Yeah.
What about professional liability versus personal?
This is from one of our healthcare online businesses, and the question that was presented was, how do we make sure our sites and any communications with the clients in the U.S., especially, are HIPAA
high-tech
compliant? Yeah.
Yeah.
And also privacy regarding business issues. Because
right.
this particular person works both with doctors about patient interaction with medicine or the medicine interaction for the patient, and also with the general consumer related to just general information they might ask about because their child is ill or something else.
Okay, so as it relates, that one of the best places to start with HIPAA is their privacy and security rule. Because it talks about how you have to protect your PHI. I always talk in acronyms, which I know is unfair. It's personal health information.
Uh-huh.
You have to protect that from your computer all the way to the recipient's inbox. So you have to make sure the privacy and security rule, they do give you some indication as to what you should have. And I will tell you this, just because I spend all of my day working in compliance, especially in the healthcare industry, it is a target right now for cybersecurity breaches. So you have to really ensure that you're backed up, that if you have encryption, that you have a backup server where you're saving information, and just to make sure that you're using secured sites in order to help protect that. So just as a small example, you want an SSL certificate. So if you look at, so say you're on the internet and at the top in the browser bar, there should be a padlock and HTTPS. That is an SSL, it is secured with SSL certification. If you see a website that says HTTP, it is an unsecured site and you should not be passing information. You should only be passing information along the secured site and make sure that your information is backed up and that you're protected from cybersecurity. I'm sure many of you have heard of the hospital system out west that cyber thief held medical records for ransom. It's called ransomware. They hold your information hostage, and then they require you to pay an amount of money to get it unlocked and have access to patient records. So it is one industry that is really vulnerable to security breaches and stuff like that. So you really do have to be very careful. Well, and Connie, let me build on something else that you said, too, that I think is really important for people to understand. If you're in the healthcare arena and you use a third party to either transmit or host your PHI, then you must sign a business association agreement with them. They should be signing that with you. And in there, in that agreement, it will establish, you know, administrative and technical safeguards. So if you're using a third-party host, they should also be giving you an agreement as well.
That's good information to have.
Yeah. And if they're not, you need to be asking about this, because maybe that's not necessary. Maybe you need to look a little bit further for an appropriate service.
But for sure. And although I am an affiliate with the Rainmaker platform, and mainly because they offer all of that information. I don't have to worry about anything. They back up every night. Everything is secure. They have great service. I've never had to worry about a thing since I've been on that platform. So,
That's great. And I would ask a couple, if you're new to this, I'd ask a couple probing questions about their servers, how many servers they back up to, where those servers are located, if any of them are abroad. Depending on the country, that could still be fine. Like if they have a backup server in the UK, the UK tends to be incredibly secure. I would feel comfortable with that. Or if you're in Ohio and their backup server is in California, then you're not going to be affected. If something happens in Ohio, you've got your backups out of state. And I would also ask them, you know, what do they do for cybersecurity? Because I will tell you this, any platform worth its weight should be able to hand you a white paper or a written document about what they do to protect against cybersecurity.
That's great information, Claudia. In 2008, when I started my first online business, we had nothing. We had no protection on anything. So we've come a long way. Okay, Claudia, let's move into explaining what the GDPR means to an online business and how that could affect our business if we don't follow those rules. I know it was created by the European Union in 2016, and we had until May 25th, 2018, if anyone in the United States was serving any clients in the European Union. So tell us what that means.
The mindset in the EU is very different. In the EU, they're very careful about personal data. And personal data in the EU is viewed more broadly than we view personal health information or personally identifiable information, or PII, in the U.S. So, for instance, in the U.S., like, your social security number would be personally identifiable information, your address. Your first and last name. In the EU, they go a step further. They view personal information as, it could be your IP address. It could be cookies that you add to your website if they can identify an individual and they're not anonymized. So they take a more robust and aggressive view about protecting data. So they're very careful about it. So this directive is 80 pages, it's like 99 articles, it's really long to read. But what it is it talks about if you have the ability to control or process the data of somebody in the EU, regardless of their nationality or where they're located, then you have to do certain things to protect their data. You have to, if you're a processor of data. So let's think about, for an example, let's think about Amazon. So Amazon has all of these customers that come to its website to order product, and they're taking your name, they're taking your address, they're taking your credit card information, they give you the option to store your credit card information online with them. So they have all this information. So according to the GDPR, Amazon has to have a reason to be able to control and process that information, and they have to have approval from that citizen, whether it's via consent or another legitimate business reason or by virtue of some legal right. But they have to have consent. And so I think many of you are familiar with sometimes you get pop-ups, or you have an opportunity to unsubscribe, or you can opt out of an email if you don't want a particular vendor emailing you, for instance. Well, with the GDPR, that doesn't work. You have to have affirmative consent. So you can't allow people to opt out or unsubscribe. They have to be able to opt in, and they have to be giving affirmative consent. So some companies, and you're going to see this a lot more if you do any kind of internet shopping, some companies will have a pop-up blocker and say, by clicking this button, you are opting in to receiving emails from us. And we have cookies on our website, and we're going to collect data about what you look at on our website, what things that you're interested in, what things that you order, so that we can provide a better customer experience, or we can market other things to you that we think that you'll like as we develop other products. So you're going to see, if you haven't already seen it, you're going to see a lot more. And so you have to have consent under the GDPR to have people's data and to continue to process it. So another thing, too, is sometimes what will happen is if you'll notice, like, on, like, the right side of your computer screen, like, you're on the internet someplace, and you'll get, like, a little ad for Talbots will pop up, or an ad for Whole Foods, or an ad for, you know, a tire company or something like that. They're using that data, and they're analyzing that data based on your preferences, and they're providing other things that they think you might be interested in. And so they're through these cookies and stuff, they're collecting data about you as well. So they have to disclose that, and you have to actually opt into it, and you have to opt in and give consent if they don't have another reason to have your data. Also with the GDPR is there are certain rights that come along with that. So someone could say to Amazon, I'd like to know what data you have on me. And under the GDPR, within 30 days, they have to provide the information that they have on them. And that person could say, oh, well, my email address has changed. I'd like that corrected. So that's a right to correction. They have the right to ask for their data to be updated and corrected, and you have to do that in their system. They have the right to object to you processing their data at all. They have the right to say, I'd like all the data that you have on me because I'm going to give it to your competitor. They have a right to do that. They also have a right, and this is a phrase that you'll hear bantered around. It's probably the most used thing, is the right to be forgotten. Amazon, you have all of this information about me. You have my credit card information. You've got where I live. You've got my first name and my last name. You've got my account linked to my husband's account. I am exercising my right to be forgotten. I want you to delete out of your system everything that you have on me. And I want you to prove that you did that, and you need to keep a record of it under the GDPR. So there's a lot, as you can see through these examples, the GDPR is taking a really aggressive stance on personal data and people's right to data, right to control their own data and understand and control how other people are using it.
Very, very, very interesting. On one side, I'm glad to hear that we have the right to control it, because I've been frustrated in the past over things when I couldn't control it. And then on the other side, I see if someone's really serious about doing business online, they're going to have the right platform that pretty much that's all built in.
And I have to built it.
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
You're going to have to do pop-up blockers, and possibly you're going to want to have a privacy policy to explain how it's used. In fact, I mean, and I don't know if you ladies have any clients in the EU. If you do, and you're just starting out your business and you have a client in the EU, you can always send a note. You can send them an email and say, you know, I understand this regulation is coming into force. I want to be really respectful of it. I have your information in your database. I have your email, because maybe you guys have done business back and forth or what have you. Will you consent to me keeping that information? Because I'd like to send you newsletters or blog posts or access to a podcast because I think you'd be interested in doing it. If you have a couple of clients, you might even be able to do this more as an email. And then you can save that email as proof that you gave that data subject the opportunity to opt in or opt out. Where it's really going to be difficult and where companies are spending millions of dollars is these big companies like Amazon and Facebook. But if you have a couple of clients in the EU, you could always do that via email and then just save that email so you have a record of that exchange. This actually already exists. There are data requirements in Canada with Canadian citizens. They aren't as robustly enforced as we think that the GDPR is going to be, but there are data protection measures that exist currently in Canada. I know the Asian countries are looking at this, and quite honestly, if you have to set up different systems for your EU clients or your folks that are considered data subjects under the EU, it could be a US citizen living expat in the EU working for an EU company, they are still covered under the umbrella of GDPR. But if you have clients, like if you have a Facebook or an Amazon, if you have clients in the EU and you're spending all of this money becoming GDPR compliant, the solutions that they come up with, they might just have solutions for everybody because it's easier instead of trying to segregate out part of their client base, just stepping up all of their privacy protections for their entire customer base. So I think that this is going to be a real cataclysmic shift really in how privacy is viewed, and I think other countries will adopt these stringent measures because these companies that are inside of these countries have to address the GDPR, and they may as well make those robust privacy measures applicable to maybe their whole client base. I can see it going that way.
Okay. Well, we have time for one more question related to refunds and disclaimers.
Yes. So I would also caution as you're doing the website to have disclaimers. And where I see this and where I get concerned about, let me back up. You can disclaim stuff in your terms and conditions. The only thing is those are sort of buried, and in general, people don't tend to read your terms and conditions or your privacy policies until there's an issue. But if I go onto a website, I don't always look at someone's terms and conditions, and I don't think other people do either. So you can put a disclaimer in your terms and conditions, but it looks a little bit buried. Where I get concerned is, so like healthcare products, like the Slim Fast, the weight loss types of things where you see people just losing an incredible amount of weight. And they do actually disclaim right on their website. So if you think that you're in one of those industries where you should have a disclaimer right on your website as it relates to the results and indicating that, you know, results could vary for any reason that really is outside of your control and outside of the good or service that you provide. I also note too, and I caution people that provide services that provide materials. If you get clients and they have to pay a set fee to have access to a training course or a training module, I would have on the page where they provide, you know, their name and their address and their cell phone number and their credit card information, I would provide a checkbox and have them actively check the box before they can complete the transaction saying, you know, once you download my materials, this is all non-refundable. And I would put it right out there for them to see in plain English. Not that you still might not have problems on the back end. People can always complain, but I would be very upfront. And depending on what your businesses are, when you decide something becomes non-refundable, it could be different for Kathy, it could be different for Sylvia. But I would encourage you guys to think about that and think at what point in time is my material or my intellectual property no longer refundable. And And I would put a statement right on your website when they're getting ready to pay and they're providing that information that when you download it or whatever you decide, at that point in time, this is no longer refundable. So people are really thinking about this and being intentional.
Okay, Claudia, this has been an eye-opener, and I know anyone listening to this later is going to learn a lot.
Thank you for tuning in, and I'm sure we're going to learn a lot more about the GDPR as we move forward in our businesses. Until next time.